Yes, Maggie Mayfield.
I adore you.
Tell me
what did you do this week?
This of course was the inauguration. That was heavy on my mind. It's been.
Were you worried?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very confused. What I saw this week in the morning of the inauguration, mm-hmm. An image of Donald Trump in front of something that was in the White House, I laughed out loud and then had to remind myself, this is real.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm very confused. And I guess this week I am in touch with how little I know. I mean, there's so much information that can be tied into the political wheels.
So heavy.
And I don't know how they really work. As much as you tell me about the Constitution, anybody tells me about it, and the political workings, the Electoral College, I still don't fucking know. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm feeling, I guess on a positive side, I want to make a goal this year to learn about the political system and how it really works and how did this happen, you know, and because I'm not
like
into
that old
it.
Cartoon, like, how does a bill happen?
Yeah. That's but that for some reason it's not connecting with me. But so it was
because it was written like 300 years ago. It's old and stuffy and no one reads it. Do we even know what it says?
Yeah, I don't even read IKEA instructions. You know, so
and those are old pictures.
Yeah, that's, I don't get it. Where's the arm of the chair?
Yes.
That was my week.
Return that. Oh, what? You bought an IKEA furniture today or this week?
No, I'm saying in general. That's my IKEA, any instructions. IKEA
take
being
it back.
The best example.
Yeah.
Even if I look at pictures, I don't get it. What was your week like?
Week was good. The same thing. I think I disappointed my mother because the Women's March was today. We're recording this on Saturday, the 21st. And she asked me earlier in the week, she's like, are you going to go? Because right after the election, I didn't march, but I definitely went downtown LA.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of did a hug tour. Like, hey, stop being so afraid. Like,
I saw those posts.
It's going to be okay. And I did not vote Donald Trump. I'm not a supporter. Mm-hmm. I also was not a Hillary supporter. And my only hope for the election this year was that we would get enough third-party votes that it would become mandatory for a three-party debate in mm-hmm. the next election. That was my hope for this whole process, that enough people would vote the 5%, which, you know, unfortunately didn't happen. So mm-hmm. So when she asked me, she's like, are you going to march? I said, no, I'm not, because this has been so heavily publicized for couple months now. And my fear, which I started to see yesterday at the inauguration, was that there would be too many people down there. There would be anti-protesters down there. And then police would get involved. It would get ugly and there would be tear gas and it would just get nasty. And if you saw anything on the news yesterday, there were rioters that were smashing windows and it did get violent. It did get ugly. And there mm-hmm. was tear gas and there mm-hmm. was the, you know, the sound grenades that they were blowing off.
Concussion
and that to
grenade,
me is like, you know what? I don't want to be a part of that. And if I'm going to protest, then I'm going to do it by making art. And I'm going to spend my money at gay bars.
Yeah. Good idea.
At places that, you know, the things that Donald Trump don't find important
mm-hmm.
are important. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go see a play. You know, I'm going to go to those underground communities and put my money there. So if I'm going to be entertained, I'm not going to spend it. I'm sorry, Arclight, but I'm not going to spend it there.
No, that's,
you know what I mean?
No, that's a great way of looking at it. And I think a lot of people were so excited about this thing. It's just a natural sort of reaction. Oh, you're not going to go? It's a well-represented
listen
protest.
To a podcast.
Yeah.
You know, one that doesn't have a lot of followers. support your arts and support
like
the people that make art.
I like that too, because I was invited to go to the protest and I turned it down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just...
I think this was more important to me to be with you and make this and have this as a timestamp.
So. Yeah, we're having a really nice experience, Maggie, with this Y-Tune Shuffle.
It's so great. I look forward to this every Saturday.
It's our musical interlude
to a
challenging week. Did you do stand-up this week?
I did. Actually, I got to do a drop-in set last night. You know, my year here in L.A. was this week. So I'm celebrating quite a milestone. And how I got here wasn't so pretty, but... to be last night doing this drop-in set for this crowd that then they're trying to build this great comedy club thing happening in Downey, which I think Orange County, maybe.
Yeah.
It was such a last-minute thing. I found out at like 5 o'clock. Show started at 9. I was like, of course I want to do it. Didn't know what to expect. Showed up. A couple Comedy Store regulars were there. I got to judge a comedy contest. And it was so good. I was like, this is why I do this. The crowd was so receptive to laugh. And they didn't want to talk politics. And it was so nice to just laugh at myself and my mom and working in this crazy radio industry. So it was great. It was awesome.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have a guest today.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Lewis Bloom, and he's phenomenal. We'll just get right to the interview.
And like 50% of our guests, we found him in the back of an Uber.
Yes.
Which Maggie and I proudly drive.
I love the Uber.
I do too.
They don't even sponsor the show yet.
We got to call Uber.
Hint, hint.
Okay.
All right. Let's talk to Lewis.
Okay, Lewis. Speaking of cars, yeah. You know, that's the yes. theme today.
Yes. Yeah.
Cars on a grand scale at Y-Tune Shuffle. Maggie has done it again.
Oh.
Maggie Mayfield, executive creator, producer, director, who is so responsible for Y-Tune Shuffle on a major scale, has brought to us Lewis Bloom.
I'm so excited to talk to you because that's how we met, was in an Uber ride.
And
I remember it was kind of a long ride. It was almost like 25 minutes.
Yep.
And you got to talking and you were talking about drag races and kind of being a public figure, and you had no idea, like you were just going on, and I asked you all these questions like, do you ever get recognized and blah blah blah, and then I spill the beans like, yeah, I'm in radio too, and you're like, what?
Yeah, that was really fun. Yeah. I mean, that's the best part of Uber, because you never know what you're gonna get.
Yeah.
yeah, it's like a box of chocolates.
I'd like to think you got the jackpot on that one.
Yeah, that worked out. That was a great, you know, I think I gave you 5 stars too.
I hope so.
You know, I mean, ultimately, you know, the 5-star part is the key thing, you know?
Yeah, yes.
It totally is.
Yes.
But totally. it was a great ride, and had a lot of fun, and, you know, here I am.
Yay! So, Lewis Bloom, you do a lot of things. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, my profession is I work in professional drag racing for the National Hot Rod Association. I work for them, mm-hmm. which is the entity that puts on the major drag racing events in the country. It is a business I've worked in since I was 14, so that would be coming up this... The spring would be 44 years.
That's amazing.
Before you had a license to drive, you were working for the National Auto Association?
Well, I worked for the drag strip in New Jersey, which is Raceway Park in Englishtown. And then eventually it, you know, kind of got bigger and bigger where I worked for the parent company, which has happened for the last, 20 plus years. But it's just one of those random things, you know, like just getting in your mm-hmm. Uber cab, where I made a phone call and the guy who won the racetrack picked up the phone. I was 14. He's like, hey, you know a lot about this stuff. I think I could, there's something I'd like you to do. I'd like to make you my announcer, which the guy's name was Vince Knapp. He was the owner of the racetrack in New Jersey. And the best part about that conversation is that he talked to me for 2 hours. It was during the winter of 74. And I found out later he really hated talking on the phone.
Wow.
So I kept his interest for 2 hours, and
That's
I was
amazing.
14. And the thing at the end of the conversation, I thought that was, you know, I've told the story before, obviously. Mm-hmm. But the thing that was interesting at the end of the conversation is he asked me what was my grades in English. And I was like, why do you want to know that? I go, solid B student.
Yeah.
Because he wanted me to announce the races, so he wanted to make sure I could actually speak and be coherent over the microphone.
And, right. And, yeah, have a thought.
14 years old, living in Englishtown, New Jersey, with who? Single parent, traditional home? Talk about what your life was like as a 14-year-old in Englishtown.
It's pretty basic. You know, my parents were, my mom is actually from Vienna. She came over in the 1930s to escape, you know, the Nazis, basically. She, mm-hmm. you know, I'm Jewish. So she came over. She met my dad in Brooklyn. He was a GI in World War II. And,
wow,
you know, they
wow.
met, and this is 1957, 58. They got married. They, you know, lived in Brooklyn. You know, I was born. My sister was born. And then typical of most of the folks middle class in Brooklyn in the 1960s, they escaped to the suburbs to have, you know, some land, some property, and, you know, a little more quiet. Plus, my dad worked in New Jersey, so that kind of made it easier. His commute was, like, just ridiculous. So we moved to New Jersey. So when they moved to New Jersey, they moved to a town called Marlboro, which is right next to a town called Manalapan, which is where Englishtown is. So what happened is that I would hear the cars at the racetrack. And this is a true story. I'd play tennis on, like, you know, during the at nighttime. And especially on Wednesday nights, I'd hear the sound of the cars. And I always liked cars. I drew cars. I was, like, always looking at cars. I just like cars. I don't know why. And my dad didn't have a driver's license till he was 33 because he lived in Brooklyn, didn't
wow.
need one.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, my mom, you know, learned how to drive probably in New Jersey, which was, I'm sure, frightening.
Yes.
But it was, you know, I heard the cars and I asked my dad, you know, what is that sound? He goes, I think there's a racetrack, you know, not far from here. I'll look into it. You didn't go on Google back then and,
yeah.
you know, sound of race cars in Englishtown, you know, Raceway Park. And I ended up going to the track. It was May 3rd, 1970 for my 11th birthday. I went with my sister, my friend Mark, who I'm still friends with. And I saw the racing in person. Didn't see Big Daddy Don Gorlitz that day, but I totally got the vibe. You know, the smell, the noise, the smoke. I went home and I bought every. Back then, you could go to a newsstand and buy Hot Rod, Car Crap, you know, all these drag racing magazines. They were right on the newsstand, mm-hmm. right next to Time and Newsweek. And you know, I just sucked it all in, and I got the job a couple years later. And here I am in Los Angeles.
Here you are on Y-Tune Shuffle.
What did your parents say when you were like, I got a job? They're like, you're 14.
I think they were happy I got a job because yeah. they're, you know, they had a pretty strong work ethic, my parents. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a newspaper route. You know, I did the typical.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I did the typical kid thing. And so I started working at the track. I started announcing. And, you know, I was pretty much terrible in the beginning because I couldn't tell a Firebird from a Camaro. But eventually I got good at that, and I did my homework, and I learned from someone whose name was Bobby Doerr, because he's part of the lexicon of drag racing. But he was really focused on teaching me, and he wouldn't let me, like, you know, wander around and, you know, not pay attention to what I was doing. He was like a taskmaster in terms of the announcing stuff, so... And that's how it all started. And, you know, it's just a random thing that happened in my life.
What do you as an announcer actually say? I mean, in baseball, it's like coming up to the plate.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it like? Ladies and gentlemen.
I would venture to say, like, you know, in the left lane from Yorba Linda, California, John Force, the 16-time funny car champion.
Well, you're known as the stat guy.
Yeah, that's what I'm called. I mean, that's what people know me in the business. Mm-hmm. The last year or so, I've had... you know, they've kind of wanted to downplay that role because
Sorry.
Okay. No, it's okay. I a guy came up to me in a restaurant in Indianapolis two nights ago and said, "Hey, stat guy, you know, I saw you in the parking lot." Now I'm in Indianapolis, which is the home of motor racing. But the guy saw me in the parking lot and he came up. He goes, "Wow, stat, you know, the stat guy's here." And like, you know, I don't tell people don't call me stat guy, but
right. They
kind of, because it was, you know, an ESPN thing. Now I work on the Fox Sports, basically.
Got
so they kind of wanted to change things a little bit, which, you know, I mean, I have mixed emotions about that because everybody in drag racing calls me stat guy.
That's your brand.
Yeah, it's my brand. So, yeah. You know, I mean, that's, you know, I'm good either way. You know, if you know my name, that's fine too. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that. So
Louis Bloom, cool stat guy.
Okay, exactly. Wait, that's not the only cool thing that he does.
Okay.
Right?
There's kind of many things,
there's
actually.
There's like lots of cool things. So before we get to the first song, can you tell me one more thing that you do that's really awesome? Because I was stalking you online.
Well, I'm actually a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
I went to art school. I went to School of Visual Arts. Mm. And it started in 1977. So that goes back to, like, I'm a kid in the suburbs. I'm in a very, you know, kind of... secular community, mostly mm-hmm. Jewish, middle class. I go to Manhattan, you know, New York City. You know, I didn't live in the city, which is a shame because I really wish I went to CBGB's more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I didn't really do that because, you know, I was kind of like...
Or Plato's.
Yeah, well, I did go to Studio 50. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I went to Studio 54 in its heyday. That was kind of fun.
Yeah.
I didn't see Andy Warhol, but I bet he was there.
Wow.
But I went to art school in New York, and I went from, you know, kind of a very safe environment to meeting people who were not, you know, I mean, people who were gay. You know, didn't see that ever where I lived. And I was like, all right, this is cool. And I met people who had a lot of expression. You know, they were artists, you know, not photographers, but artists who were really, you know, doing things different. I was actually in Keith Haring's class.
Oh, geez.
Now,
Jesus Christ.
I'd see him in the hallway and never spoke to him. I thought he was, you know, I just looked at him. I was like, I have nothing in common with that guy. But I would see his work, his drawings on the subway, where the subway posters would be all over New York. Now, if I was smart... I would have ripped them off the wall.
Steve Sweeney did that, a writer for Conan O'Brien. He did exactly that.
Well, that's genius. One of the guys I went to school with, who's his name is Joe, I'm still friends with him, he traded photography of Keith doing his work for some of his art. And he's actually, his photographs of Keith, I think, are going to be in the Modern Art along with some other stuff.
Wow.
You know, because Keith's art, I mean, you know, I didn't even like his work back then. I thought it was like, you know, it was like, kid stuff.
Uh-huh. Crack is Whack is one of the most famous Haring posters.
I mean, amazing. But as I've gotten older and my taste for modern art has become, you know, greater, Andy Warhol and Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns, I mean, stuff you can see is it the Broad or the Broad? I never know how
Broad.
To say it. Yeah, the Broad. I mean, stuff like that. You know, Jeff Koons. But you see that artwork and now I really love it. Back then, I just didn't get it. You know, I was 18, 19, 20. But I'd see him in the hallway, go like, "What's up with that guy?" And you know, and now you know, years later, I know that his, you know, he was ahead of the curve by a mile. Unfortunately, died of AIDS, and he was an early victim to AIDS. And you know, I really wish that he would have seen how loved his work is all over the world. Mm. Right. I mean, I've been to museums all over the world, and there's a Keith Haring, and I always go like, "That is really cool."
That is cool.
So I went to art school in New York, photography, worked in the city, worked on photo shoots. I've been David Letterman's office. I've been in really cool factories in the Midwest. I've been in places where you have to sign the release because AT&T is doing something you're not supposed to know about. And corporate photography, fashion, been to Europe on photo shoots. And I always did the drag racing and always did the photography. And it's really hard to make a living as a photographer. It really is. Mm. And I know a lot of talented people who they have a hard time making a living. Mm-hmm. Drag racing for me, I'm like the one person who does what I do. Even though there's other people who might be able to do it, but not at the level I do, you know, my work at, and maybe not in the sense that I can, you know, I can get involved in everything in production. You know, I took the photos for the TV show for ESPN. I was like the photographer. So it's all kind of plays together, but I love photography. I photograph. I went to, you know, and coming to LA, the light here is ridiculous.
Mm. So this time of year, especially, the winter time.
Yeah,
oh my God.
Absolutely. So every day it's like, if I'm not at work, you know, I try to take my camera and go someplace and make photographs, and you know, you could see him, you know, if you know, it's one of those things where if people see him, great. If they don't, I still do it for myself. It makes me feel good. I want to do some exhibition stuff someday, and I want people to, you know, be able to purchase them. I have like a lot of photographs of Asbury Park, which is, you know, goes back to the music thing. That's another thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something I've had published and people have bought over the years because I photographed Asbury Park, which is a very great Jersey Shore town, you know, amusement park, you know, it's you know, all the imagery in a certain person's music is about this place. And I photographed it in the 70s and the 80s when nobody really did because it was kind of like forgotten. There was some riots in the 60s. People did not go there. But I just fell in love with the place. Pinball machines, you know, beer, you know, the arcades, you know, the smell of the place, the music. And that's where my friends and I went. You know, every weekend we go to Asbury Friday and Saturday. It's, you know, it's where
your life goes from 0 to 100, like in all aspects.
Well, and that's just, you know, there's other things too. I mean, I think what it is that there's a certain point in my life I said, you know, you could really have a lot of fun and just get involved in everything, whether it's a sport or whether it's culture, whether it's food, forget it. I can go out to eat every night of the week. Of course,
right?
my bank account probably wouldn't like that, but there's so much out there, and even like meeting you in the Uber cab, I would definitely drive Uber because I think it'd be a great place to meet people, to hear their stories, and who can't use a little bit of cash, right?
Exactly.
Oh my God, absolutely right. And to say that as a person who's lived it and done it, I think it's also important to note that for an individual like me that prefers to watch other people do this stuff, it's an equally rewarding experience, you know, to have the gusto to kind of go out there and get involved. Wonderful. But not all of us, you know, possess that. Thank you. You know, because sitting on the sidelines and watching the show is a very fulfilling, wonderful life. We couldn't have it without each other.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing. And what's the beat? What's the sound? What's the music? Where do your Y tunes come into this whole?
The music.
Yeah.
Let's play the first
this
song.
This is number one of the five, Lewis Bloom.
I'm excited.
Here we go.
All right. I'm going to start. I think I'm going to go from like the top to the bottom. Or the bottom to the top. Yeah, number five to number one, because the number one song really is what it's all about. So this is a song by the Beach Boys. It's off of Pet Sounds, the first song in the album. And it kind of sets up a life. To me, it kind of sets up your life. It's like the Beach Boys, it's like surfing, it's like California dreaming. And the other thing, too, about that is that there was a band called Beaver Brown.
Brown.
Yeah, they were in the movie Eddie and the Cruisers. If you really
remember Eddie and the Cruisers.
Yep. On the Dark Side is their like their big song.
Yeah.
So
you can crank it down just a tiny bit. We get the.
Oh, that's fine. Okay.
Ah, I love that.
Y-Tune Shuffle. It's on repeat. That's another show. Y-Tune's repeat.
Turn it down.
Yeah, just turn it down a little bit. So
there you go.
That's it. You're the DJ as well.
Yeah,
as the guest.
That's going to be scary actually.
So Eddie and the Cruisers.
So Eddie and the Cruisers, the band Beaver Brown would play all the time in the Jersey Shore, and they would always play a Beach Boys song before they would play. And I saw them probably 100 times. And it's like Pavlov's dog. When you heard that song, you know, you're like, oh, this is going to be really good.
Excellent.
Plus, there was something at the end sometimes that was the real reason why we're there eventually, which is the fact that Bruce Springsteen would get up and jam with them.
Wow.
So we'd be in a bar. You'd hear the Beach Boys song, which is not specifically that one, but I think that song transcends all Beach Boys. It's like,
I think so too.
It's like one of those defining songs for the Beach Boys. And Pet Sounds is such a great record. I can listen to it. I actually have it in vinyl because I moved to LA. I'm, you know, got a record player. It's like hipster 101. Get a record player.
Get an Amoeba sticker for your Beamer.
There you go.
I like that place.
Yes.
That's where I bought Pet Sounds, actually.
Indeed.
Amoeba. So it kind of sets up the you know, that whole moment. You know, I'm in the bar. I'm 20 years old, 18, 19, 20, looking at every girl in the place going, should I talk to her?
Yeah.
Will she talk to me? Because it is a social experience. My friends are there. My sister's there. And, you know, Beaver Brown, they play the Beach Boys. They come on. You know, they play a great set for an hour. And then everybody in the place is looking around going, did he show up? Is he here? Is Bruce here? And then, you know, you'll see like a guy in a hooded sweatshirt or some guy in a leather jacket. You'll be like, this is going to happen.
Oh, man.
You know, when you're a kid on the Jersey Shore, that is a major deal. And
that's royalty.
The Beach Boys music kind of segueing that part of my life. And most of the picks I have kind of segue other bigger things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, picking out five songs is really hard.
Yeah, that's what everybody says.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think that's an easy thing to do, but I'd say that, you know, the Beach Boys, Pet Sounds, that song, because it kind of is the opener. And, you know, I surf, you know, because as you said before, the spectator aspect, you know, watching people do things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I lived for 20 years, two blocks from the ocean on the Jersey Shore. And I really don't like being in the ocean, like that concept.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know it's kind of funny,
right? I can relate.
I don't want to be in the ocean, but I'm going to get out there and surf.
It's nice to look at it.
So one of my friends, I used to go snowboarding with him. I love to snowboard, still do it, just like going through the trees on a beautiful day, the mountains, you know, because you see another part of the world, and I've traveled extensively. Thanks to my job, I get a lot of air miles, which I've always cashed in for fun things. So I go snowboarding. My friend goes, you know, you look like you could really surf because the way you make your turns is like a long boarder on a surfboard, just these graceful turns. And so he gave me a board, which I went in the Atlantic Ocean for a year, caught one wave. I didn't know what I was doing. I, you know, was always in the way. Surfers are real intense. You know, when you're when you're the kook, that's what they call it, like the kook.
The kook.
They will read you the riot act, you know.
It's
a turf.
Yeah. The beach is a turf.
Yep. So I eventually got a long board versus like a short board, caught some waves, and then it was like, boom, it was like a full-time obsession. So when I'm on the board, the Beach Boys music comes to my head. And even though there's a great line I heard recently, the Beach Boys never surfed, Chuck Berry never went to high school, and Bruce Springsteen didn't drive cars.
Wow. Like,
and that's what they sung about.
That's a great quote.
I'm quoting Bruce. But that's, you know, the Beach Boys never surfed. Chuck Berry, who's, you know, I love his music too.
Uh-huh.
Buddy Holly, Chuck Berry, you know, that raw, early rock and roll.
Hail, hail.
Yep, exactly. So, you know, that's the Beach Boys. I mean, that's
the soundtrack when you're out there.
Yeah.
I always thought it was a little bit more zen than that.
I'm not the most zen person, I've been told.
Oh, okay.
I've done some like meditation, and I was like, you got to be kidding me.
This is hard.
Yeah, but I did it, and it was, you know.
Has it been 10 minutes? No, it's 30 seconds.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, meditation, it's not what you think. That's a joke.
Oh.
I know.
Because you're not supposed to think when you... I'm the kind of comedian that has to explain. That's what makes me unique and special.
Do you got a rim
unpaid.
Shot on that board right there?
And driving an Uber. What's the next jammy jam?
Okay, now I got to find it here.
We're hitting the shuffle.
Okay, so the next one I'm going to go with.
Oh, my God. Talk about the 70s. I love this song.
The Clash. London Calling.
Oh, I love this. This is a Y-tune connection here, man. I got a story behind this one, too.
So I'll just, like, turn it down a little bit. So, first off, The Clash, like the punk, you know, the punk scene.
Yes.
Now, I could easily pick a Ramones song, and I love the Ramones. I've seen it many times. But The Clash, to me, took it to the next level. It was, you know, a little more sophisticated than the Ramones, you know. I've seen the Ramones play, you know, 30 songs in, you know, in 40 minutes, you know, because it was 1, 2, 3, 4, and then, you know, bang, you know, like, and Joey Ramone, I mean, I worship his, but The Clash, Joe Strummer, you know, Mick Jones, those guys took it to the next level, the punk you know, the punk scene in England. And then I saw him play once in Asbury Park in a place called Convention Hall, 1980-81. And they were touring for, I think they were touring for this album. I think it was this album. And it would just blew my mind, you know. And that's, once again, you come, you know, a typical suburban kid, you know, very mm-hmm. safe environment growing up. And you see these guys basically spinning their entire soul out on the stage, mm-hmm. you know, and it's way more edgy. It's way more based on a political, you know, moment, you know, the way they felt about living in England, the way they felt they were being treated. So that's what I really loved about The Clash. And I think, you know, it's music that has stood the test of time, mm-hmm. you know, 1980-81, and I'm still listening to The Clash. And London Calling is just like the Beach Boys song. It kind of opens the window to the whole entire Clash experience, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's that song or, you know, any of their other, you know, edgier songs.
Do you think that this was a political awakening for you in terms of like a global perspective? Because, I mean, you must have been still pretty young in your early 20s.
Oh, yeah. I think it kind of opened me up to the fact that people didn't always agree with the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that people were not getting what they wanted out of the system.
It was Reagan and Thatcher,
yeah,
period.
Yeah. You know, I voted for Barry Commoner, by the way.
Oh, you did?
In one of those elections.
Good old Barry.
Yeah. And his platform was that oil, we have to, you know, oil is not.
I was separating hangers at Rothschild's department store. I really don't remember. I remember when he got shot, Reagan, but I don't remember Barry then.
No, I voted for Barry Commoner, and that embarrassed my family greatly at the time. I think it might have been Jimmy Carter and Reagan. I'm not sure who was in that election.
It was a three-party race. Yeah, yeah, it was Barry.
Barry Commoner was like the out-of-the-box. And I read about him in Rolling Stone because that's what I read when I was, you know, 18, 19 years old. I was like, right. I like this guy. You know, he's got it figured out. It was about the environment. It was about, you know, oil. And, you know, that oil is going to be a problem. It's going to be a geopolitical problem.
Right. And this is, I mean, this may be happening again, this sort of tendency, this sort of energy, this what was happening then is kind of happening now.
I was gonna say, I think we saw this back in like 2001, 2002 when Bush was elected, because for me, that's when I was in my early 20s and NoFX was really, it's like a huge underground band.
Yeah.
The Green Day album that came out, American Idiot.
Yep.
So that was like a big political push. And I think you're right, David. I think that we're about to come see a big art movement.
Yeah.
I think
music,
on a grand a scale similar to when I saw The Clash, they opened for The Who at Rich Stadium where the Bills play.
Yeah.
And I just remember I had smoked opium for the first time time at that particular concert.
Wow.
When Train in Vain, they started doing Train in Vain, a huge fist fight broke out.
Wow.
Unbelievable sort of like energy that was happening. I don't think anybody got hurt, but it's
Train in Vain's a pretty awesome song too.
God.
I didn't go to that show, but I have the soundtrack which they put out on my phone, my iPhone, which mm-hmm. is pretty much your device for music.
I got to find a photo. My buddy Vic Dwiesacki took me at that concert. I had a fedora with a bandana around it, like a Dillinger type fedora.
And you thought you were so cool.
I was cool. Until I fell and broke my knee on, like, running down one of the... It was a Who concert with General Admission.
Okay.
Oh,
that's not a good thing.
And London Calling, my first time to London, I was at in South Kensington in my hotel room, and I had a little transistor, and I turned it on. I swear to God, it was London Calling. Unbelievable moment.
That's pretty good.
This is a Y-Tunes connection. Where
Absolutely. I feel it.
Okay, well.
But The Clash, you know, and the thing about The Clash is that you see him once, you think, wow, I can't wait to see him again. Mm-hmm. And then the band breaks up, and then mm-hmm. Joe Strummer unfortunately passes away. So, you know, you'll never hear that again.
Yeah.
It's just never going to happen again.
Glad you got there. Do you remember where you were the first time you heard it?
The Clash?
Mm-hmm.
Back then, I listened to WNEW-FM, which was the big New York rock station. It might have been on that station. It could have been
WNEW.
It could have been WHTG, which was the Jersey Shore alternative mm-hmm. station, but I'm not. I think that was before that, so I'm not exactly sure.
Who are your best buddies that listen to this kind of music with you? What were their names?
My sister Randy, pretty much.
Really?
She liked The Clash, and some of my friends. A lot of my friends are kind of a little bit conservative when it comes to some things.
In high school and in middle school.
Well, in high school,
this time in your life.
I'd say in that time of my life, it was the people I went to art school with.
Oh, okay.
But I think the music stuff, my sister and I were kind of on the same program. I think I went with her to see The Clash.
Cool.
I think it was the two of us.
Nice.
You know, and there are other people in my life who definitely are associated with music, you know, bands I've seen. We'll get to that in a little bit. But
cool.
The Clash is, you know, still love that. I love the album cover.
Yeah.
I think they were ahead of their time, and I think they're their message is still appropriate in many ways.
God save the Queen.
Song number three.
Funny you say that.
It's a weird show, man. A lot of weird things happen on the show.
You kind
of
nailed the next one in a way. So I'm scrolling through my playlist
top five,
right here.
Your pick five, your top
okay.
five.
Okay. It's not God Save the Queen, but it's on the same album.
Song. Yeah. I fucking love this fucking
yeah.
song, man.
It's
and you know, you don't hear it all the time.
No.
You know.
Now, let's go back to the fact that here I am, a kid from the suburbs, pretty much. I'm not the edgiest person in the room by a mile when I was a kid. I was just like skinny, geeky kid. And, but I, for some reason, just love that punk thing. And Anarchy in the UK, and I love England. I mean, I've been there. I've been there, luckily, to tour around and I dated a woman who lived in England for a while, and that was really great because I got to see a lot of the countryside. England's an amazing place, the people. And I'm a huge fan of the Queen because I have a picture of Queen Elizabeth on my desk, which I saw a picture of her in the National Portrait Gallery near Piccadilly Circus, Piccadilly Square. And I saw this portrait, and I bought like the postcard, and I framed it because it's a beautiful photograph.
That's
and
awesome.
I watched The Crown. I'm like obsessed with.
She's
know.
Scheduled to be on the show March 15th.
Nice.
Yeah, that's amazing. What her five are?
That's a big guest. That is a big guest. And like Downton Abbey, I'm like, I can watch Downton Abbey. You can
Hallelujah.
Yeah.
Hallelujah.
Well done. But Anarchy in the UK, you know, just the whole, just like this. I mean, they're horrible musicians. He could barely sing, but it's just a thing of beauty. And yes, God Save the Queen's awesome, too. And you know, they made one album, really?
I haven't heard this song in 20 fucking years.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, actually heard it. I mean, it's just one of those things. That's amazing how much time goes by.
Wow.
And I can remember being with Kevin Dunn, Bill Elliott, Brendan Martin, whose sister worked a graveyard shift. We had their house at night in high school. And just losing it and destroying furniture to this music,
yeah.
You know, and it's well over 20 years, I think, since yeah. I've actually heard the song, and I'm right back there now. See, that's the beautiful thing about music. I'm fucking back there right now.
The thing about the Sex Pistols is that I remember watching something on the news with in my parents' house. I lived with my parents, you know, until I was way too old, but it was they had a paneled den, so mm-hmm. paneling, you know, the big heavy square TV. And I remember the local news covering the Sex Pistols, talking about the punk scene. Like, these were the punks, and they spit at people, and people slammed it. And my parents were like, you know, what? And I'm like going, this is cool. And, and I think I gravitated to the Sex Pistols a little later in terms of actually buying their music. But I knew something was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to art school. You know, as I said, I went to school in New York. And then when Sid and Nancy, that whole thing was like a big thing in my college because we had a lot of, you know, half my class was, you know, they were really into punk. You know, they had the piercings, they had the hair. You know, I still look like a guy who could be an insurance salesman among all these people, but I kind of got what they were talking about. I felt it. And, you know, when Sid and Nancy, when they died, the people were in tears. And I was like, you know, I don't get it. You know, like, but I knew the music was important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I've you know, really gravitated to the Sex Pistols and their music, and I love that album. Never Mind the Bullocks, I think, is just a brilliant album.
Oh yeah!
I mean, there's so many great songs. And here's the bonus stat, as I like to call it, in drag racing. I have a friend who is a rock photographer. His name is Mark Weiss. I went to college with him.
Rock music or
yeah,
rock.
He did all the hair bands. Yeah, that's funny. Rock
again, late
he
but
takes,
good.
He takes beautiful hair pictures of rocks.
Okay.
Rocks are hard to photograph. Trust me. One of my favorite photographs ever is of a pepper.
A chili pepper?
No, just a green pepper. Edward Weston, just the pepper. Just Google it sometime.
The pepper?
Like a pepper. It's like a it's an amazing photograph. So so let's go back. So my friend Mark Weiss photographed all the hair bands in the 80s. Like mm-hmm. he was John Bon Jovi's photographer.
Mm.
I mean, he was in Cream, all those magazines. He was really like the guy.
Okay.
And he's had a great career. He's still photographing. And he didn't like alternative music. It just wasn't into it. So he gave me a chance to go photo. Like in the early 90s, he gave me like his press credential to go photograph all the alternative bands.
Wow.
So I went to Lollapalooza.
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
Pearl Jam. You know, I took pictures of Pearl Jam. All different, you know, really cool stuff. But one time he called me, he says, listen, he says, I have to go to Washington. The Sex Pistols are playing like a reunion tour, of course, without, you know, Sid Vicious. Do you want to join me? And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, you're going to drive me to Washington, and I'm going to get to see the Sex Pistols and hear that music. Because, you know, ultimately, you know, Johnny Lydon, you know, sang, I pretty much believe I'm correct, that he was the vocals, you know, on a lot of that stuff.
I think so.
And it was just like, it was amazing. And I heard like Anarchy in the UK and God Save the Queen in a live room. You know, it wasn't the exact same thing because they were older guys.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing, you know, and it was a great
thing. Well, I mean, if you saw Muddy Waters in 1967 and you saw Muddy Waters in 1977, like I did, I mean, it's like there is something still there. It's not just the same thing, you know.
I did that with Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra played not far from where I grew up at like a big open air theater. And I was like, you know, I want to hear Frank Sinatra's voice in person
because one
day it won't be here.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, forgot words and made mistakes. And, you know, he basically said the same thing a couple times over. Like, you know, I'm like, they don't write him like that anymore. And like, I'm like, all right, okay, we know that. But it was still Frank freaking Sinatra singing Summer Wind, which is, you know, that would make my top five, actually, you know, now that I think of it, because I think it's a brilliant song. But just want to hear people like... Tony Bennett, I always wanted to hear him sing. So I finally found a way to hear him sing in person.
Wow.
And I saw him with Lady Gaga, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And how vital it is for so many of us that are able to connect to, you know, the musical score of our lives and the importance, and how artists continue to struggle with being compensated, or how or why anybody would ever question how important that artist in particular is. And it's so easy to connect with, and I just love hearing people like yourself. So what we do the show, right?
Exactly.
Why do the shuffle? It's because we all get down this way with those kinds of connections, and it's important.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, lead us on the next journey. What's song number four?
Okay, number four, ladies and gentlemen. Throwing into my announcer voice.
My engines are revved.
Yep. Coming up next.
At the line. Driving the Chevy Nova 69.
I'm so glad that's not a thing anymore. Radio guys aren't like.
Oh. You know, Howard Stern really changed that whole thing.
I thank God.
And I listen,
conversational.
Yeah.
I listened to Howard Stern from day one on WNBC.
WNBC.
Yeah. 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 You got to say it like I'm, as Howard.
Yeah.
I can do that. And I listened to, I remember driving in my dad's four-door Chevy. It was blue. It had vinyl seats during, like, the summer. I mean, you'd be stuck to the seats. And I listened to WNBC, and I heard this guy saying things. I'm like, did he just say that?
Uh-huh.
Did he just really do that?
Uh-huh.
And then I got over the fact, the shock value, because this is on terrestrial radio, not on satellite. And I realized how intelligent he was, how funny he was, and how I completely agree with 99% of the things he said.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, nobody does an interview better than Howard.
Honest.
Yeah.
An honest interview.
I don't listen to, because of the way, you know, my drive to work, and, you know, I listen to him at work, I'll put the headphones on. But when he interviews somebody, and it's someone I'm curious about, I can, you know, I've listened to some of the interviews 3-4 times because they're so good.
Mm-hmm.
So, Baba Booey. Or actually hit him with the hind, is I think what people say now. But Howard is really, he's a big part of my life. And, you know, the conversational aspect of, you know, the fact that he got rid of that whole, you know, and I love when he makes fun of DJs. He'll cue up a record and he'll try to hit the post, as they say.
Yeah.
And he'll be like, hey, coming up next, you know, and I literally crack up laughing.
whether he wants to admit it or not, Larry King inspired him, whether he wants to admit, because that's who we all started listening to and connecting with and originally the talk format.
Yeah, Larry King.
I laugh every, I don't hear much anymore.
Connecticut, come in.
Yeah, that's right. Chicago, you're on the air.
Yeah.
But anytime somebody does a phone prank and the mark is bought into it, hook, line, and sinker, and then the caller will throw in a Baba Booey, Baba Booey.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It just, nothing makes me laugh harder. that segue. I want to do one. I want to get one off.
The host of our show, his name is Dave Reif. He's the host of the drag racing show, and I'm, you know, a big fan of his. And I watch what he does because I sit right next to him in the TV booth. I kind of help. I pretty much help him. And, you know, my job is to make sure everything gets done right. And Dave's got a tough job. And in St. Louis, the guy who runs the racetrack sent him a text like, hey, can you say, if you talk about me or the track, say hit him with the hein, which is one of the Howard phrases.
Uh-huh.
And he said it, which it was a Friday night show, which, you know, a couple hundred thousand people probably see. But that can go either people like, you know, like Howard or hate him. You know, there's no mm-hmm. middle there. It's like talking about anything else right now. He said it, which, you know, I thought was really cool because I laughed out loud. And then Howard actually played it on the Howard Stern Show.
Oh, that's great.
And so the funny part is Howard goes, he played the clip and he said something like, who watches drag racing? Like, you know, and I was like, I do, Howard, you know. And he made some other comments that were really funny. But to get it on that show was like, for me, and, you know, there's a lot of people who race or in drag racing who listen to Howard. I know who they are.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, hey, did you hear what Howard said this week? You know,
oh,
so, you know, there's people who definitely like Howard. But I thought that was kind of cool.
So that's
that he
a
did
big
that.
Deal for you to like be on the Howard Stern Show.
That would be a big deal. I just want to listen to Howard. You know, uh-huh. That's really it. And I want him to just talk to people. I think he made it okay to talk about yourself and talk about
Seinfeld
how you feel.
Can thank him very much
yeah.
for that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What's the deal? And once again, Seinfeld, car guy. Well, he was talking to Jay Leno because he's on Jay's show, his YouTube show. And he goes, you know, I like to talk about cars. I want to talk about cars. I think about cars. I like when people want to. It's not like, you know, hey, you're on Seinfeld. It's like talk about
exactly.
a rare 356 Porsche, you know, something. I mean, that was like, I listened to him and go, I kind of get that.
Yeah.
Totally.
You know?
Totally.
All right. You want to go for my next song?
Yes.
Okay. Here we go.
Fuck yeah.
I'm killing you, right?
Oh, God. I'm there, man. You got me there. Sounds like a bathhouse right now, but you got me there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. How Soon Is Now by The Smiths, which really is How Soon Is Now by a guy named Stephen Patrick Morrissey.
Yeah, right.
Who basically is, like, in my top five favorite people on the planet. I don't know why I love Morrissey so much. But his sense of humor.
It's like you don't have to know. Well, it can just be.
You should know that you do.
Yeah.
Not knowing is not the problem. Thinking you should know is the problem. Eckhart Tolle. I'm dying up here. You don't know who Eckhart Tolle is?
Uh-uh.
Okay, anyway.
I love the irony of Morrissey.
Yeah.
Like, you know, heaven know I need a job. Heaven know I'm miserable now. You know, a double-decker bus crashes into us to die by your side. I mean, this is like the gateway song, just like, you know, London Calling, all you know, like the Beach Boys song, mm-hmm. like the Sex, like Anarchy. And it's the gateway to like, oh, I want to learn more about this artist. I'm going to buy his records. I'm going to go to his concerts. And Morrissey, I've seen probably 20 times, which for me is not a lot because other artists I've seen hundreds of times.
Uh-huh.
But Morrissey is, he is just, I just love his... His, you know, the way he sings, his voice, just the lyrics, and I, you know, there's a lot of sadness in his music. You know,
mm-hmm.
You know, he's not a happy. You know, I always tell people, I said, when he's sad, I'm happy.
Wow.
Because the more sad Morrissey is, the more his music is just gets better and better, mm-hmm. and his performance, and then I'm happy because he's miserable. You know, which plays right into the Morrissey concept. You know, the mm-hmm. way he what he's about.
Right.
I don't know why I'm. This has come to my mind, but when I think drag racing, the all-American motor sport, which,
yeah.
you know...
I know where you're going.
We can all get involved. Is Morrissey a popular song that would be played to the fans?
No. See, that's the whole thing in my life. It's like...
I mean, you're the big drag guy,
yeah.
you know?
Like, I work in professional drag racing.
Yeah.
I love burning rubber, the smell of nitro. I love, you know, I love... See... The thing about drag racing is that I like all of it because
mm-hmm.
I know so much about it. I'm not being, like, you know, arrogant. It's just that I'm so involved in it every day of the week
yeah.
that I know all the little details. It's like watching – I'm a huge baseball fan. I love the Mets. The Mets are, like, you know, right up there in my top five favorite things to do. I'm obsessed with the Mets. Like, that's the connection to my dad, you know.
Yeah.
He was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. The Dodgers left, moved to Los Angeles, broke his heart. He hated the Yankees,
uh-huh.
which I do too, and he took me to a Met game in the 1960s because they were the National League team.
The Metropolitans.
Yep. So that is the connection to my dad. You know, that's how it all works. But, you know, So I'm in this very American sport, you know, and people are very conservative, which, you know, I respect their opinion. Mm-hmm. And I'm not exactly that way. I went to art school. I'm New York. I live in downtown L.A. And, you know, but that's okay because we're there for one reason. We like to watch racing.
Yes.
You know, and the thing I learned about drag racing when I was young, when I went to the racetrack when I was 14 to work, I was like the first Jewish person to work at the racetrack. And there was a couple guys there who just didn't really like that. Mm-hmm. Like that was, they gave me a little bit of a hard time. So I had to earn their respect that I was not just some weird kid, you know, what is he doing here? He's not like one of us.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But what I loved about Raceway Park in particular is that...
Was it a kid or a Jewish kid?
No, a Jewish kid.
Yeah, because you said I was a kid.
Yeah.
But you're talking about a Jewish kid.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's the right way to frame it. Mm-hmm. But what I loved about Raceway Park in the 70s is that Raceway Park had a very intense following from the African-American community, specifically from Newark. Mm-hmm. And my owner of the racetrack knew that they were great customers. So there was never there was never an issue with him. He would go talk to him and sit in the grandstands. Hey, what do you guys want to see? You know, because he knew how to make money. Like, what's my audience? What do they want to see? And I was surrounded by these people, and I got to know a lot of them because I would go sit in the grandstands with them and just watch the races and talk to them. That drag racing was colorblind. Unlike, you know, my parents were still saying Yiddish words that I didn't really like about, you know, black people, African-American people.
Wow.
And it was one of the first places I went to. You know, I went to a segregated school, you know, a desegregated, I don't even know. My school in Brooklyn, they bust in kids from Bed-Stuy. Mm-hmm. You know, which,
integration.
You know, yeah, integration. So, mm-hmm. Thank you. So that was a place where I met people who were different from me. Mm-hmm. You know, looked different, completely different. And then I went to this school in New Jersey, which was basically, you know, mostly, you know, we're all the same. So then I went to the racetrack and I'm like, oh yeah, there's other people.
Yeah.
And they have different experiences. They come from different places.
Right.
And they're totally cool.
Yeah.
What I loved about the drag strip in the 70s is that it was, you know, people just wanted to see cool cars, go fast, and watch racing. Yeah. And that was what I loved about it. So, you know, and that's the thing with the drag racing guy, the art guy, culture guy. I've flown to races like in Texas and gone to the art museum, the UC Museum of Fine Arts on Thursday night to go see an art exhibit. Most people might be at, you know, other, you know, doing whatever they do. Yeah. And that's me. That's what I, you know, that's who I am. I mean, you
all
know,
parts of you.
Yeah. Cause it's
unapologetically you.
Yeah. Cause all of it's interesting. It's the stuff that motivates me.
Hell yeah.
So let's get back to Morrissey.
Yeah. Maz. I was going to ask you, this seems more like I know you said you're happy, even though he's very sad, but it seems like the kind of music that if I had my heart broken, I'd be like, just keep it on repeat.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Was this a go-to breakup album for you?
No. Fortunately, the breakups recently have been few and far between. But,
oh, good.
But I would say that, you know, the thing about Morrissey that I like is just, the thing about Morrissey is that he has a great catalog of music, mm-hmm. and because of the Smiths, you know, you go back to the Smiths and some of his new songs. He's really an amazing performer, but he only plays for like an hour and 10 minutes. So it's very intense because you're hoping that it's like he plays the songs you want to hear. And what I love about Morrissey is that when he gives a great performance, I saw him at the Garden with my sister about 2 years ago, you know, one of the biggest places, Madison Square Garden, New York City, that I saw him play, mm-hmm. you know, like thousands of people. And it was depressing. He was really into the whole, all about, he's a vegan. You know, he plays a song called Meat is Murder, mm-hmm. you know, and it was just dark. It just got too dark. And I'm like, what are you doing, dude? This is your biggest audience probably in years. And you're just like, just sad.
You're blowing it, man.
Yeah, and there's so much joy in his performance. And I saw him like 2 weeks later with one of my friends, Matt, who is one of my, the go-to music friends, who's a drag racing person, you know, The Cure, The Smiths. We've seen some incredible shows. So I see him in Chicago in a small theater, like an opera house, and it was unbelievable. Hmm. It's like the same set list, but the whole vibe of the show was completely different. So when you go see him, you never know what you're going to get. You never know that he's going to play an hour or an hour 15. I've flown across the country to see him from New Jersey to like San Francisco, and he cancels when I land. It's like, oh, he canceled the show.
No.
Yeah.
Morrissey.
Yeah. He's really, you know, when you buy tickets, you're like, I hope he shows up. I hope he plays.
Interesting.
The music is just, the songs, You know, the some of them I find very funny.
Right.
You know, I mean, people, I think either when you meet someone who likes the Smiths and Morrissey, you just like you just look and you go like, I totally get it. You know, like I know why you like it, and it's one of my favorites. He really is. I don't know what it is.
Even though he's so moody.
Yeah, and he's we're the same age. Mm-hmm. I think I'm older than him by like a couple weeks.
Wow.
And I love when he's singing. He's throwing the mic around, and you know I've seen him up close. You know where I can really look at him, and you know and just you know I'd love to talk to him actually. See him in a cafe in L.A. someplace. He's lived all over the world, so mm-hmm. You never know. You might bump into him.
Well, just tweet at him. That's how you talk to people now. You just tweet.
Was that five?
Nope.
No, we got one more.
Oh, thank God.
Okay.
You know, this is a great five.
All right.
Four so far.
One, two, three, four.
Now, we're going to go someplace that is like, this might kind of, for some people, go like, really? But this is the most important song of my life.
Let me get ready.
Here we go.
I think I know what it is.
Well, it's almost a cliche, actually, if you know anything about me.
Here he is. The boss has arrived.
It's almost like a cliche.
Not.
No, it's not. I mean,
not at all.
This is a great American songwriter, singer-songwriter, man. This is
the 1978 Agora Ballroom version for you Bruce fans out there. Which was much bootlegged. Now they re-released it because Bruce has finally let people in the archives. We'll start with that line. Sprung from cages on Highway 9, right?
Route 9.
Yep. So Highway 9 pretty much is the road I grew up near in Central Jersey. Now Bruce grew up in Freehold. I grew up in Marlboro. Those towns are separated. They border each other.
Okay.
So a lot of what always attracted me to Bruce... And specifically, this is the song. It's the gateway song. It's like the gateway drug.
Uh-huh.
It's like, this is the thing. And I know exactly how it all happened. It's a little bit of a story. And I think that's what we're about here, telling stories.
Yes.
So, I'm like 17 years old. And one of my friends, his name is David, who lives in San Francisco, lived in L.A. for a long time. He comes over and he goes, there's a band called Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. Okay. Yes. And they have this great record. It's kind of a blues soul record. And we should listen to it. And this is like, I was listening to Aerosmith. I was listening to all this, like, whatever's on the radio. You know, Aerosmith, you know, that's kind of what stands out is the music I was kind of listening to. Whatever's on WNEW. But I heard Southside Johnny. It was so different from anything I ever heard. Because it was bluesy and rock and soul. And I was like, this is amazing. You know, I was like, wow. And what I did is I looked at the liner notes and... Bruce Springsteen wrote a lot of the songs, and Steve Van Zandt, who, you know, Bruce's consigliere, you know, he's part of it. And so I went and bought Born to Run. So this is 76. Born to Run had already been out for a year. So I bought Born to Run, put it on the turntable, and probably it didn't leave for a year.
Mm.
And then the real defining moment is that I was, I worked at a ski area right by my house. I was the lift operator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I basically like made sure people didn't...
Mount Airy Lodge? Where was it at?
It was the YMCA ski area in Central Jersey.
Oh, okay.
They actually made snow, which is amazing.
Beautiful.
I mean, who would even do that now? You know, and like it was like a hill.
Beautiful.
But I worked there. I made some extra money. And I'll never forget a DJ named Vince Gelsa, who was the New York... He was like the cool DJ on WNEW-FM. And he played Born to Run three times in a row. And he pretty much said, like, I think Bruce Springsteen's God. You know, which, you know, I don't really, I mean, I kind of get why people say stuff about things, but I don't really go there anymore. You know, that concept, I don't, you know, the God part, fine, but the, you know, so-and-so is God. I just, you know, I would never say that. I say that as kind of jest. I would never
My
say
My senior English teacher, Ken Pickens, made us all write essays about the New York Times article, The Boss.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because of that same type of connection to Bruce Springsteen. He's an amazing artist. He's a writer.
Yeah.
He's
Well, his book, you know, he just put a book out.
Yeah.
And it was. I read it in like 10 minutes because
I gotta get it.
It was really like, it was my childhood. Mm-hmm. You know, the same, I had the same, some of the same teachers he did in high school.
Wow.
You know, so it's all kind of
there. That's cool.
It's all kind of there, you know. And so Vince Gelsa plays Born to Run three times in a row. And I was like, this is it. This is the thing, you know. He talks about places that I've been to, you know. I've driven down Kingsley. That's in the Darkness album. I've been sprung from cages on Highway 9. Hemi-powered drone screened out of the boulevard. That's like the drag racing aspect. I mean, you know, lots of car talk, you know, even though he didn't really drive a car until he was, didn't have a license until he was probably in his mid-20s, I found out in the book.
Yeah.
But Bruce Springsteen, I've seen him play. First time I saw him play was in a bar. It was in the Stone Pony, which is a bar in the Jersey Shore. I saw him get up on stage, 1977.
Stone Pony.
Yep. He jumped up on stage and jammed with a band. I actually have a photograph of it because I had my camera with me. And I saw him play guitar and I was like, and I actually met him and talked to him. He could not have been nicer. He's, you know, and then I saw him play with the band like a month later in the bar, like sing the, you know, Thunder Road, Born to Run, all the Jungle Land, all the classics. And I was like, literally, you know, he was hitting me with the guitar. I was so close. And I've been chasing Bruce, my entire life. And I've seen him. I lost track, but I would imagine, because I've seen him in bars easily, like bars, like just not announced gigs where he just shows up. I've seen him play like in the living room, you know, which is in New Brunswick. He played in this bar that was, in essence, a living room. But I've seen him play easily 250 times.
Wow.
And I've seen him in Europe. And I met my girlfriend 4 years ago at a Springsteen show in Virginia. She's from Germany. I'm like, what are you doing here? She's like, well, what are you doing here? And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. And she's like, where are you from? I'm like, I'm from Asbury Park. And she's like, the holy grail for Bruce fans.
Yeah.
You know, it's like living in.
That's a cool thing.
You know,
for
and,
her, yeah.
And I've seen. Last time I saw him, we went to see him in Pittsburgh and Philly, but I saw him in Rome this summer. And that was you know, in not far from the Colosseum. I want to go to a show and go like, oh, this is boring, and not have to go, you know. But the guy's 67 years old and still brings it.
Yeah, I was really down the other day, a couple weeks ago, and I had to rejuvenate and survive this particular night by three or four in a row of Born in the USA. You know, and it's so important in high school. That song was, prior to me enlisting in the military, there was some connection I was trying to draw from that whole story and justify. But wow, what a five, Lewis.
It's different. You know, you got punk, you got Morrissey. I don't even know what you'd say about Morrissey, but, and it's, you know, the Beach Boys.
And the
it's
a beautiful mix,
yeah.
Man.
And,
is it time for first concert?
Yes.
Oh, that's the last part of our show.
This is your favorite part.
Yeah, this is, and I you may have already tipped it. I don't know, but what was your very first concert?
Well, let me think here. I think it was Chicago and the Beach Boys. my mom took me to the Garden.
That's so a lot of my mom and I's.
Yeah,
for first concert.
You know, when you're 13 or 14 years old, she took me to the Garden State Arts Center, which is off the Garden State Parkway. And I saw that the first show I went to on my own, I'm pretty sure, was Aerosmith and Ted Nugent at Madison Square Garden.
On your own? Aerosmith,
yeah.
Ted, wow.
Yeah, we took the train. We went to the Garden and saw Aerosmith. I still appreciate Aerosmith's music. And, you know, I'm not really a... I'll wander over to, like, the classic rock channel once in a while, you know, on either Sirius or... I have to tell you, L.A. has got great radio.
Yes, it does.
And it did. Oh, it does have great radio now.
We talked about that in the cab, right?
Yes. 20 years ago... Nah, but now today it's wonderful.
That's because I'm here now.
You're here now. Maggie Mayfield.
Maggie made it happen.
Maggie did make it happen.
New York radio, very disappointing. But when I came, you know, I drove to LA from New Jersey, and I'm driving around, I'm checking out, I'm like, oh, this is kind of good. This is, you know, it's got everything. You know, classic rock, you know, the alternative rock station, 98.7?
Mm-hmm, so good.
Yeah, and, you know, public radio, I mean, jazz. I like classical. I'll listen to that sometimes too. So, it really,
so glad you use Uber.
Yeah,
because, you know, that's how we got Lewis here, through the Uber.
Yes,
Maggie's Uber. I drive the Uber. That's how we get a lot of our
I might soon. You know, I'm thinking about it.
Uber should sponsor this show. Hint, hint.
That'd be a good sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? We got it. Yeah. Anyway,
instead of comedians in cars, it could be people in Uber cars. You know, conversation, something. You know,
yeah.
Got to think of a clever name.
Music in my Uber.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Hey, tell me a little bit, can your fans get in touch with you somehow, or can they follow you on a social media platform?
I am on Twitter, and
do
my
you
Twitter
use
handle.
It?
Yeah, I'm very much active in Twitter, and it's, let me just make sure, because it's changed. It's at Lewis Bloom, that's L-E-W-I-S, Bloom, N-H-R-A.
N-H-R-A?
Which is National Hot Rod Association.
Okay.
And I'm also on Instagram. I don't really put my, like, personal photography on Instagram.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Because I think it's just too immediate, it's too quick, it's there and it's gone. You know, I still, you know, maybe I'm wrong. And I had a discussion with a young photographer in Seattle 2 years ago about this. His goal was to be like a big Instagram photographer. And I'm like, well, people only see your pictures, you know, the size of a phone.
Mm-hmm.
I go, I want to be on the wall of the modern art. You know, that's still my, you know, that would be like my dream.
Or
you know.
Behind someone's couch.
Okay. I've done that. That's definitely happened. So Lewis1B on Instagram. And that's how you pretty much get in touch with me.
Thank you. Lewis Bloom, you've been fantastic. Thank you for coming
Five
on
stars.
My Team Triples. Yes.
5 stars.
Just and you can see my photos, lewisbloomphoto.com.
Lewis Bloom.
If you want to see my photos, because I'm really passionate about them. I mean, they're all over the map. You know, most people when they show their work, it's like one thing. Really great pictures of apples.
Mm-hmm.
So my pictures are all over the map. So it's that kind of hurts me in a way.
Lewisbloom.com.
Lewisbloomphoto.com.
Well, thanks, guys.
Yeah.